Good morning, good afternoon. If you would like to identify yourself, I would appreciate it. We're going to wait another 5 minutes to see if someone else comes on. Today is Tisha B'Av.
This is Jamie.
How are you, Jamie?
I'm well. I'm sorry I'm a little late.
That's all right. Today is Tisha B'Av, and there are a lot of halakhic restrictions on what we study, because it's, in some sense, it's not a joyful day, and in another sense, it is a joyful day. It is called a holiday. We've prepared for Tisha B'Av last Sunday in our classes. We've prepared during the 3 weeks by many days saying the Tikkun Rachel. But I am going to not do what our normal patterns are. I will tell you where to find the handout, which is on the Unique Astrological Times link under the section of Tisha B'Av. The title of the link is the Talmud on Tisha B'Av, and it's the section of Gittin. I believe it's 55B and 56A. It's a free handout by the Art Scroll Company, a publisher of Jewish books. I'm going to say the Ana B'Koach, and I invite you to join me, followed by the verse on certainty, where we will first do a L'shem Yichud, and then we will start the study. It's not our normal pattern of opening, because those things would bring joy. Please join with me in saying the Ana B'Koach. Ana B'Koach. Gedula chemicha kati terura Aleph Bet Gimel Yitach Tzadi Kabel Rinat Amcha Sagvenu Baharenu No Ufre Shayan, Sintet Nun. Na Gibor, Dor Shevi Yehudcha, Keva Vat Shamrem, Yom Gimel Dalet, Yud Kav Shin. Barchem Tacharem, Rakame Sitkatcha, Tami Gamlen, Etet Resh, Sadi Tat Gimel. The letters of the month of Av, the Kaf that created the planet we call the Sun, and the Tet that created the constellation Arya, the astrological sign of the lion, Leo.
Hey, Angela.
Tassim Kadosh Bero Tucha Na'el Adatecha Ketufet Ketunan Yachid Gea Lamcha Penei Zofrei Kedushatecha Yud Gimelamed Hei Zayin Kuch Shavatenu Kabel, Ushmati Akatenu, Yodea Ta'alumo, Shin Kufal, Tzadi Yutas. And the eighth verse we say in a whisper. We're now going to say a verse on certainty that comes from the Sulam commentary on the Zohar. It is from Parashah Yitro, it's Pasuk 29. We will first say Elishem Yehud. Elishem Yehud Kutshabri Kulishkin Debit Urkimu Udhilu Udhilu Urkimu Leakda Elishem Yudhe Bavazhe Biyehuda Shalim B'Shem Kol Yisrael Limud Torah Mitzvah La'asok Torah Mitzvah Vayehino Am Adonai Eloheinu Aleinu Ma'asei Yadeinu Kananei Aleinu Ma'asei Yadeinu Kananeihu Rabbi Abba Amar Bekama Atar Tanenan Tiku Chabari Barichu Koma De'aved Leila witata kolaihu kishot liovada dikshot beleilach mila bialma divae barnash ledafya aulan haga beyakulana dehakulu ovada dikshot inun. The handout is available on the Unique Astrological Times link underneath the two pictures on the right of every Hashem webpage, or on mobile devices, it's at the bottom of the page. Please scroll down to the section titled Preparation for Tisha B'Av. There is a link there that says Talmud on Tisha B'Av, Gittin, pages 55b and 56a. That is a PDF file that is a free handout from the Art Scroll companies. It's a translation of their English and Aramaic Talmud in the section of Gittin, G-I-T-T-E-N. We are going to start on page 2. Where it says Gemara. To give you a little background, there's within the Talmud, there are these two sections, one called the Mishnah, one called the Gemara. The Mishnah was written first, it was written earlier, and it is more cryptic. The Gemara is a commentary and an explanation on what people meant in the Gemara. There are another section called the Baraitas that is not included. The Baraitas were the personal notes of the students who listened to the Mishnah being given orally. The Gemara. The literal meaning of the first part of the Mishnah is, there was a Sikiron in Judah when people were being slain as a result of the war. But from the period in which people were slain as a result of the war and on, there is a Sikiron in Judah. The Gemara points out that this is the opposite of one would expect. Obviously, I need to give some background. The war that is being talked about is the war by the Romans that eventually destroyed the Second Temple. The word Sikiron, I'm unfamiliar with, but in essence, my belief, my thinking about it, my intuition, is it's saying a belief or a discussion about why the war happened and why the temple was destroyed. I'm not going to read the Aramaic, which is taken from the Mishnah. Just know that if you were to look on page 1, in the middle of the page, there's a whole bunch of columns on that page. But right, the middle column is the Mishnah. And you will find that verse, those Hebrew words, in the Mishnah. Now, if during the period in which people were being slain as a result of the war, there was not a Sikriton in Judah, how can the Mishnah say that after the period in which people were slain as a result of the war, there is a Sikriton in Judah? Ceding of land to a Sikriton was surely more frequent during the war than after the war. One other comment that I probably should have made earlier is that the ceding of, not the ceding of the land, but the word Judah. Judah refers to the kingdom of Judah as opposed to the kingdom of Israel or the kingdom of Ephraim, which are the same thing. This is when the land, the people, were split into 10 tribes and 2 tribes. Now, that is an oversimplification of the actual split, because in both lands, both kingdoms, there were cities that belonged to the tribe of Levi and to the tribes, to the Kohanim, to the priests. So there is really 11 tribes and 3 tribes, but those aspects of the 10 and the 3, or the 11 and the 3, it's really the tribe of Levi is one tribe, just it was living in 2 different territories. The Gemara explains the Mishnah. Rav Yehuda said, when the Mishnah says there was not a Sikriton in Judah during the war, it means that the law of a Sikriton, the law outlined in the continuation of the Mishnah, was not applied in Judah during the war. Rav Yehuda continues by explaining why the law of the Sikriton did not apply in Judah during the war. Rav Yehuda, they, Titus, which is the Roman officer and king, and his officers who led the war in Judah, issued three edicts. The first two edicts were issued during the war, and the last one after the war. The first edict was, whoever does not kill a Jew whenever he has the opportunity to do so shall be executed. The second edict was, whoever kills a Jew must pay a penalty of 4 zus. The last edict was, whoever kills a Jew shall be executed. Therefore, when the first and second edicts were in effect during the war, since idolaters could kill Jews without fear of meaningful retribution, a Jewish landowner whose life was threatened by a precon would, as a result of his duress, sincerely transferred ownership of, and I'm going to the second column, so I have to scroll back up, of his land to the precon. Thus, the precon definitely assumes legal ownership of the land. Under such circumstances, the law of the precon is not applicable. But when the last edict was in effect, after the war, and Jews were afforded proper protection, they, the Jewish landowners whose lives were threatened by a precon, would say, let him take my land today, and I will claim it from him in court tomorrow. The owner does not necessarily cede his land permanently to the precon. Under such circumstances, the law of the precon is applicable. As I'm reading this, and obviously my understanding of the word precon was incorrect, but as I'm reading this, I'm remembering that there's a jubilee, there's a yovel, where all land is returned to the tribe and to the people of the tribe, to the families within the tribe, within the individuals within the tribe. There is no person who, at the beginning of a jubilee period, is not a landowner. So when it says the landowners ceding the land to the precon, it needs explanation. Having mentioned the war waged by the Romans on Judah, the Gemara deals with this topic at length. Rabbi Yochanan said, what is an illustration of that which is written? Fortunate is the man that always fears the consequences of his actions, and he that hardens his heart will come to harm. This verse is illustrated by the following three episodes in which tragedy struck because people failed to consider the consequences of their actions. As a result of the incident involving Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. As a result of the incident involving a rooster and a hen on Har HaMelech was destroyed. As a result of the incident involving the side of a carriage, Betar was destroyed. Of those three items mentioned, the first two I'm aware of, I've never really heard about the side of the carriage incident. I'm not going to explain those Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, because I think the Gemara will do so. But if by the end of the class it doesn't become clear, I will give you some explanations. The Gemara recounts the incident involving Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. As a result of the incident involving Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. A certain man who had a friend named Kamsa and an enemy named Bar Kamsa made a banquet. He told his attendant, "Go and bring Kamsa to join me at the banquet." Let's scroll down. Page 4. The attendant went and mistakenly brought him Bar Kamsa. When the host arrived at the banquet and found Bar Kamsa sitting there, he said to Bar Kamsa, "Look here, that man is the enemy of that man. What do you want here? Get up and get out." Bar Kamsa said to him, "Since I have come, let me stay, and I will give you the value of whatever I eat and drink." Let's scroll down. To page 5. The host said to Bar Kamsa, "No, no, I will not let you stay." Bar Kamsa said to him, "I will give you the value of half your banquet." Again the host said to him, "No." Bar Kamsa said to the host, "I will give you the value of your entire banquet." The host said to Bar Kamsa, "No." He grabbed hold of Bar Kamsa with his hand, stood him up, and ejected him from the banquet. Bar Kamsa said to himself, "Since the rabbis were seated at the banquet and did not rebuke him for the way he treated me, it is evident that what he did was acceptable to them. I will go and spread slander against the rabbis in the royal palace." He went and told Caesar, "The Jews have rebelled against you." Caesar said to him, "Who says so?" Bar Kamsa said to Caesar, "Send them an animal as a sacrifice and see whether they offer it in their temple." Caesar went and sent a fine calf with Bar Kamsa. As he was going to Jerusalem, Bar Kamsa caused a blemish in the calf's upper lip. Or as some say, he caused a cataract in the eye. Either way, he ensured that the blemish was in a place where it is considered a blemish for us, for offering in the temple, but is not considered a blemish for them, for offering outside the temple. Although the animal was unfit to be offered in the temple, the rabbis considered offering it for the sake of peaceful relations with the Roman government. Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkunlas said to them, "But people will then say that blemished animals may be offered on the altar." The rabbis considered killing Bar Kamsa so that he would not be able to go and tell Caesar that the offering had been refused. Rabbi Zechariah said to them, "But people will then say that one who blemishes consecrated animals is put to death." Rabbi Yochanan interrupts his narrative with the following observation. Rabbi Yochanan said, "The tolerance displayed by Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas in refusing to have Bar Kamsa put to death destroyed our temple, burned down our sanctuary, and exiled us from our land." I'm scrolling down. To the change of page, oh, change of the page in the Talmud to 56a. The narrative is resumed. Well, before we do the resume the narrative, we really do need to discuss if Rabbi Zachariah was correct in his statements about what people would think. Because this discussion also applies in our days today with respect to political discussion. Isn't it the responsibility of the leaders of the political movements to teach both sides of the question? So rather than let the people say what they will say, isn't it the responsibility of the rabbis to teach why they did what they did? How would that have impacted the issue? The question I am asking, the answer is really something each person needs to develop in their own minds, their own views of the world. The narrative is resumed. He sent against them to Nero Caesar. Nero set out to attack Jerusalem. As he approached Jerusalem, he shot an arrow towards the east, and it fell in Jerusalem. He shot one towards the west, and it fell in Jerusalem. He shot an arrow towards each of the four directions of the compass, and each one fell in Jerusalem. Then he asked a young boy, "Tell me your verse, the verse you are currently studying." The boy recited to him, "I will take my revenge against Edom through the agency of my people Israel. God will ultimately punish Edom. Its treatment of the Jewish nation through the agency of his people." He said to himself, "The Holy One, blessed be he, wants to destroy his house. And he wants to wipe his hands clean on that man, on myself." He ran away and converted to Judaism, and Rabbi Meir was descended from him. Rabbi Meir was the student of the Acher. Remember the story of the four who entered the Pardes. The third one became the Acher, the other. He did not die, but he stopped practicing Judaism. Rabbi Meir was his student, and Rabbi Meir always tried to bring him back to the ideas of Judaism rather than what ideas he had started to follow. Continuing to read at the top of the second column. Caesar sent him, Vespasian Caesar, against the Jews. Vespasian came and besieged Jerusalem for 3 years. There were three wealthy men in Jerusalem: Nachdimon ben Gurion, ben Kalba Sabua, and ben Tzitzi Hakeset. The Gemara explains these names. Nachdimon ben Gurion was so called because it once happened that the sun miraculously pierced, the Hebrew is Nakda, the clouds on his behalf. And Kalba Shavua was so called because anyone who entered his house as hungry as a dog left satisfied. Ben Tzitzit HaKeset was so called because whenever he walked, his tzitzit trailed behind him on cushions. He walked only on cushions fashioned from fine fabric. Some say that he was given this name because his seat cushions was placed among those of the nobles of Rome. Scrolling down. Two pages. Whenever he went, there was an audience with the emperor. The narrative continues. One of these three rich men said to the rabbis, "I will sustain the people with wheat and barley." And another one said to the rabbis, "I will supply them with wine, salt, and oil." And another one said to the rabbis, "I will supply them with wood." The rabbis gave special praise to the one who promised wood. His pledge was the most generous, inasmuch as wood is required in greater quantity than the other staples, as borne out by the following. Rav Chisda entrusted all his keys to his attendant, except for the key to his storehouse of wood. For Rav Chisda said, "To bake a storehouse full of wheat into bread requires 60 storehouses of wood." These three men had enough supplies to sustain the residents of Jerusalem for 21 years. However, there were these Baryoni among the people. The rabbis had said to the Baryoni, "Let us go out and make peace with the Romans." The Baryoni would not let them do so. They said to the rabbis, "Let us go out and wage war against the Romans." The rabbis said to them, "It will not be successful." The Baryoni arose and burned down those storehouses of wheat, barley, and wood, and there was a famine in the city. The term Baryoni is referring to political ambitions, political parties. In the modern translations of the Christian Bible, there is the Sadducees and the Pharisees. These two groups were political parties in our modern terminology. This is a teaching of some of the modern rabbis. As these political parties, they disagreed. One party wanted to make peace with the Romans, and one party did not. The party that did not said no to the peace with the Romans. The other party burned down the storehouses, thereby shortening the war, because the people were going to have to give in or starve to death. Continuing to read, the Gemara relates one of the tragic effects of the famine. Martha, the daughter of Boethus, was the wealthiest woman in Jerusalem. She sent out her agent, saying to him, "Go and bring me some bread made of fine flour." By the time he went, the bread made of fine flour had been sold. He went back to Martha and told her, "There is no more bread made of fine flour, but there is white bread." She said to him, "Go and bring me some white bread." By the time he went, the white bread had been sold. He went back to Martha and told her, "There is no more white bread, but there is coarse bread." She said to him, "Go and bring me some coarse bread." By the time he went, the coarse bread had been sold. He went back to Martha and told her, "There is no more coarse bread, but there is barley flour." She said to him, "Go and bring me barley flour," going back up to the second column. By the time he went, the barley flour had been sold. Although she was not wearing shoes, she said, "I will go out and see whether I can find anything to eat." Some animal dung stuck to her foot. She became nauseated and died. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai recited the following verse about her: "The delicate and the pampered woman amongst you who never ventured to set the sole of her foot upon the ground." And an alternative version of the cause of Martha's death. Some say she ate the dried figs of Rabbi Tzadok and became nauseated and died. The reference to Rabbi Tzadok is explained. For Rabbi Tzadok fasted for 40 years so that Jerusalem should not be destroyed. He was so thin that when he ate anything, it could be seen from the outside going down his throat. When he nourished himself after concluding his fast, since he was not able to consume solids, they brought him dried figs. He would suck out their moisture and then discard them. The Gemara concludes the story of Martha, the daughter of Boethius. As Martha was dying, she took out all her gold and silver and threw it into the marketplace. She said, "What do I need this for? This is fulfillment of that which is written. They will throw their silver into the streets." The Gemara returns to the central narrative. And Sikra, the head of the Barnioni in Jerusalem, was the son of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's sister. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sent the following message to him: "Come to me in secret." Abba Sikra came. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "How long are you going to act in this way and kill everyone through starvation?" Abba Sikra said to him, "What can I do? If I say anything to the Baroni that is contrary to their agenda, they will kill me." Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "Find a way for me to get out of the city. Perhaps there will be a small measure of salvation." Rabbi Sikra said to him, "Make yourself out to be sick." Scrolling down two pages. "And let everyone come and ask about you. Then take something that smells bad, such as the carcass of an animal, and lay it down next to you in your bed, so that people will say that you have died and your body is beginning to smell. Then let your students enter and take hold of your bed and carry it out. And do not let anyone else enter and carry your bed, so that they will not detect that you are unexpectedly light. For the Baryoni know that a living person feels lighter than a corpse." Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did as he was advised. Rabbi Eliezer entered and took hold of his bed on one side, and Rabbi Yehoshua on the other side. They carried the bed to the gate of the city. When they reached the gate, the Bar Yoni who were guarding the gate wanted to stab Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai with spears to make sure that he was really dead. Abba Sikla said to them, "Shall the Romans say that the Jews stabbed their rabbi?" The Bar Yoni wanted to shove Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to see whether he would cry out. Abba Sikra said to them, "Shall they say that the Jews shoved their rabbi?" The Bar Yoni finally opened the gate for him and he was carried out. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai reached the Roman camp, he said to Vespasian, "Peace be upon you, O king. Peace be upon you, O king." Vespasian said to him, "You are liable to death on two accounts, for I am not a king and you are mocking me by calling me a king. Furthermore, if I am a king, why did you not come to me until today?" Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "To that which you say, I am not a king." That is the end of the three sections from the Talmud. To finish reading the story, which is a marketing ploy by the art scroll organizations, you would need to buy the book, which is available for your smartphones for $10. And that's $10 each book of the Talmud. And for the hard copy printed book, the cost is closer to $30. Does anybody have any questions? We did discuss Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. I have to go back and read what the second item was. The incident of the rooster and a hen on Har HaMelech, on Mount David, actually. There is a story elsewhere in the Talmud, or probably in this section further on, that Rabbi Akiva was walking with two of the other martyrs. And of those two martyrs, all three of them saw a fox going through the ruins of the temple. And the two rabbis started to cry because their perception of the fox running through the ruins of the temple was how horrible the destruction of the temple was. Rabbi Akiva, instead of crying, was laughing. And the two rabbis asked Rabbi Akiva why he was laughing, because the human reaction would have been to cry. Rabbi Akiva was saying that there are two prophecies about the temple being rebuilt and the coming of Mashiach. And one of those prophecies describes the fox playing in the ruins. So his explanation was he understood that since actually the way those prophecies are worded, one prophecy makes a prophecy about the destruction of the first temple. And the second verse quotes that first verse and then says that the third temple would be built, and it relates to this fox playing in the ruins. And Rabbi Akiva explained that because he had never seen the prophecy of the first prophecy, the fox playing in the ruins, he now knew that since that prophecy had come true, the prophecy about the rebuilding of the third temple will be true. Essentially, what we have read is about hatred for no reason. And for many years, and I've said this before last Tisha B'Av, but in case you didn't hear it, I've asked that question for many years. What is hatred for no reason? Do not you know? And many people in answer to that question, many rabbis in answer to that question, will refer to the 10 children of Jacob who sold Joseph into slavery. That's hatred for no reason. It's your brother. But in reality, Joseph, according to the Midrash, had done Lashon Hara to their father about the 10 brothers. And so they had a reason called jealousy, because Joseph was closer to Jacob. They had a reason, but it wasn't a good reason. But it's still not hatred for no reason. So what is hatred for no reason? And the Midrash that I'm quoting, I'm paraphrasing, speaks about the upper temple, because while the temple in our physical world may seem to be destroyed, in the upper worlds there is still a temple. There's still the root of a temple. And the Midrash says that Abraham goes into the temple on Tisha B'Av, and he looks around, and he sees that no one is there. So he cries to God, "Where are my children? You promised that they would inherit the world. They would be as numerous as sands in the sea, as sands on the beaches." And God's answer is, none of them are righteous. So they cannot be here in this upper temple. Moses then starts, like he did with Sodom and Gomorrah. Aren't there 50 people who are righteous? Aren't there 50 of my children who are righteous? God says, no. So he goes to 45. God says, no. He goes to 40. God says, no. He continues through his process till he gets to 10. And God says, no. The things are, Moshe is talking about his children, not the people of Sodom and of Gomorrah. So he starts at 9. No, there are no righteous children. 8, there are no righteous children. He goes down one by one until he reaches 1. Hashem, isn't there even one righteous child of mine? God's answer is no. there are no righteous children in this generation. There are none, because each one of them thinks that they are better than the other person. By thinking they are better than the other person, they exhibit hatred for no reason. Now, to explain this midrash, to explain this thought, every human being is created with a purpose in this lifetime, a purpose to achieve their tikkun, their purpose to change something about themselves, to change something about the world. And each one of these people are given the tools that they need to change themselves, to achieve their tikkun. They're given all of these tools in the potential idea that if they delve into those tools, they learn to use them, they will make the changes and achieve their tikkun. So the question can then be asked, how can I be better than someone else? How can I be faster, stronger, more learned than someone else? Because all of those things are gifts from the Creator that allow me to do my spiritual work, to achieve my tikkun. So how can I say that I am better than anyone else in my heart? Does anyone have any questions? The normal pattern would be to say to you right now, have a good week. Shalom Gadol to all. But I cannot say those things on Tisha B'Av, because due to the morning practice, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, we are not to greet another. So unless there's a question, I am hanging up.